We're discussing how flight attendants are handling COVID, what we should know about this work, and what changes they're advocating for within the airline industry. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. American Airlines plans to incentivize employees to get a COVID vaccine. The Dallas Morning News reported on a letter last week sent to the airline's workers telling them that they can get an extra day off work next year and a voucher worth $50 to use on restaurants or stores. How do you feel about encouraging or requiring vaccines? Do you feel safe flying today? What sort of changes do you think should be instituted when it comes to air travel? 800-642-1234. Paul Hartshorn Jr. has been a flight attendant for over 20 years. He's a spokesperson for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants Union, which represents American Airlines flight attendants. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
If you could give us a capsule, a lot has changed since the pandemic started last year. How has the job of a flight attendant changed since then?
Yeah, the job has changed in ways that we never imagined. We're coming up on the year anniversary. We're there of when the pandemic started affecting our careers greatly. We took office at the union in April of last year amidst total chaos with the flight schedule and everything due to the spreading pandemic. You know, first they halted flights to Asia, then they would halt flights to Europe, then domestic flights were affected. It was just a spiral downward. Jobs were lost quickly. We had to deal with not just the loss of job loss, but also dealing with a new mask compliance policy. So the last year has been really difficult, to say the least.
Picking up there on the mask compliance, before President Biden ordered masks to be worn on commercial aircraft, what did conversations with passengers sound like when flight attendants tried to enforce mask wearing in flight?
So really, it started in April of 2020 when, you know, we were still told that the masks should be saved for healthcare workers. Of course, we agreed with that. We were told they weren't necessary for us. We pushed and lobbied in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of transportation unions to get that changed because we knew this was spreading by air and we knew it wasn't safe not to have protection. So in April of 2020, we finally got American Airlines to move to require masks. Unfortunately, they only required it for the flight attendants. And that made no sense to us because you were protecting to some extent passengers, but we had no protections either. As we moved on to the next couple of months, we kept lobbying Congress, the Department of Transportation, to please require these masks on board for our protection as we saw flight attendant COVID-19 cases skyrocket. That didn't happen until June, where they started requiring masks for everyone. And as we went on through the summer, the mask requirements became more stringent. But I will say, since Biden has issued the federal mask mandate, it's become much easier to ensure and to have passenger compliance.
Have you seen passenger compliance? And what happens when a passenger refuses to wear a mask?
We have procedures on the aircraft that we can notify American to let them know that we have non-compliant passengers on board. And many times it's not us that notice this, right? It's more the passengers that are sitting around them. And it often turns into a verbal and sometimes physical altercation between the passengers, not even the flight attendants who may not be on the scene right just yet. So there is a way. We have a reporting system that American takes very seriously, and our corporate security department will either meet the flight or reach out to the passenger if they're having compliance issues.
Do you feel, Paul, that flight attendants are equipped with ample training in de-escalation techniques?
I think we have excellent training. We have yearly recurrent training that we have to attend, which is very intense. It does include disruptive passenger training, things of that nature, and it's very thorough. I will say what we're not trained for is what we've seen since January 6th on the aircraft of different groups of passengers having altercations with one another, politicizing the mask compliance, things of that nature. And that has been something very, very difficult for our flight attendants in the cabin. And it's something that we continue to work on in Washington for safer, more stringent rules regarding that and fines.
We're talking with Paul Hartsorn, who's a flight attendant, longtime flight attendant, spokesperson for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants Union. We're discussing the state of air travel, the work of flight attendants in this pandemic. Taking your questions, do you travel by air? What have you noticed in flight? And if you work in air transportation, the air and airline industry, how has your life changed on the job since the pandemic started? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, what are penalties like for people who don't wear masks? Are they put on a list? What are the steps?
So there are a number of steps. That does include a no-fly list, I believe, at each airline until the masks are no longer necessary. But with President Biden's federal mandate, there can be possibly monetary fines attached to a non-compliance incident.
Has your union, do you feel, had to apply pressure to get safety precautions? Or do you think airlines, and Americans specifically here, have been proactive in following CDC guidance?
I think as a union, we've always followed the CDC guidance. It has not always been easy getting us to the place that we are today. I mean, I think we can all agree that it's very difficult to physically distance on board an aircraft. We really don't have that option, whether the aircraft is full or half empty. So this is why in April of last year, our union, along with other transportation unions across the industry, other airline unions, lobbied Washington, talked to our representatives, our senators, and really made the push to make this mask compliance or the mask wearing mandatory, because we knew that this spread by air. It wasn't a secret, and we weren't protecting our passengers or our flight attendants to the extent that they needed. So this has been a long time coming. It took us months to get to the point where everyone was required to wear it, where they were required to wear it on the jetway, in the airports, just for everyone's safety. In addition to that, we've also spent a lot of time talking with the Department of Transportation and then Secretary Elaine Chao to try to come up with uniform cleaning standards across the industry. You know, I think the goal here is to have travel demand return, right? We want everyone to feel safe, and we want our business to come back. We want our employees to be employed. It's the same story across America, right? So we worked to try to get those cleaning procedures uniform across the country. We were so far are unsuccessful, but we are still speaking with the DOT, the new administration, and the DOT to see if we can get that done, just as an added security measure for passengers to feel comfortable and feel safe returning.
You have made steps, though, on in-flight air quality and air purification.
For sure. The airlines really stepped it up there with the filtration system, the HEPA filters and things of that nature. And they've really begun, I guess the good part about it is really begun to explain it to the passengers. I know that there are announcements and videos on video equipped aircraft now explaining how it works. So I think that goes a long way to ensuring just a little bit more safety and security when you're on board our aircraft.
Let's bring in Gary now in Madison with a question. Hi, Gary.
Yes, good morning. We're going to be flying out shortly here. And just wondering the requirements for masks on planes, the type of mask. You see all kinds of different masks, and is there a certain standard required, or as long as the nose and mouth are covered, is that sufficient?
Hey, Gary, thanks for reaching out. This is Paul again. Yeah, there are definitely standards, and I know that I'm assuming it's any airline, but if you're flying an American, there are steps on the website, AA.com, exactly what is and isn't allowed. As this pandemic progressed last year, as I said, American and other airlines realized that obviously this was a problem not requiring masks. And as they required them, the rules became more strict, right? So I think they removed things such as handkerchiefs over the face, or gaiters as they're called. They removed masks with valves, so those are not allowed either. To make you a little more comfortable, your whole process, once you get to the airport, American, I'm sure other airlines has extra masks for you as well. So my suggestion is always to have it when you walk in the door. But if something happens to yours, or yours isn't in total compliance, our ground staff will make sure you have one that's in total compliance before you even get near the aircraft.
Gary, thank you for your question. Safe travels. We are with Paul Hartzorn, a flight attendant spokesperson for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants, which represents more than 27,000 flight attendants at American Airlines. Are you one? How has life on the job changed since the pandemic? How have passengers responded to mask wearing and other situations? Did you become infected with COVID while at work? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing air travel in the pandemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly a year ago, airlines received billions of dollars in aid through the CARES Act relief package. A portion was aimed at keeping frontline workers like flight attendants on the job. President Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package is expected to be voted on by the House today. It's the final hurdle before heading to the president's desk, and it would contain the extension of that payroll support program for airlines, keeping employees on payroll through September. Do you work in the transportation industry? How has the pandemic affected your career? Did you lose your job or have to take unpaid leave? What can you say about airline travel now, or what do you want to know? 800-642-1234. Paul Hartzorn is a spokesperson for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. Paul, let's look a little bit more closely at the airline workers who've been affected with lost paychecks, more than 45,000 lost medical benefits. What is the situation like now with employment?
Sure. So as we know, as you mentioned just now, the CARES Act that was passed, the payroll support program for aviation that was passed in last April of 2020, guaranteed that airline workers, frontline airline workers such as myself, anyone from mechanics, ground staff, flight attendants, pilots would be connected to their pay, but most importantly, stay connected to their health care through October 1st. That was one of the first things we did. As I said, my administration took office in March, and we were just thrown right into that. So the first thing we did was start lobbying for that money to keep everyone connected. As of October 1st, that money expired, and I'm sure you followed along and had heard that we were working on Capitol Hill with all the labor unions and really all the airlines to get that extended through March of this year to ensure that the announced layoffs that American and other airlines had announced would not happen. At American alone, on October 1st, they announced a furlough of 19,000 workers on one day, and that was just the numbers from American. It was upwards of 75,000 people losing their jobs. Now, we talk about paychecks. We talk about keeping money coming in. We were incredibly worried about having these people on the street losing access to their health care, and that during a pandemic, and that was something that we could not just let sit. So we did lobby Congress. We worked with our representatives. We worked with some of our champions in the House of Representatives, Peter DeFazio, Aviation Subcommittee Chairman Rick Larson, to get this extended. Unfortunately, there was a little gap from when we had the payroll support for aviation extended, but we got all of those employees back on the job as of December 1st with their pay and with their health care. So this infrastructure bill, this payroll support program for aviation, is groundbreaking. It's never been done before, and it really has literally saved lives.
When you look at the months ahead, though, I mean, analysts are predicting air travel won't recover to pre-pandemic levels until 2024. And then you see Spirit Airlines planning to start training new pilots and flight attendants, anticipating the rebound of leisure travel. Is American gearing up? What do you see in the future?
We're hopeful. You know, we are hopeful on the domestic front, and the Caribbean and Mexico front, where we see strong travel demand now. So we're hopeful. We know Americans want to travel. We know they're ready to get back out there. Internationally is a little more difficult to predict, simply because different countries have different entry requirements. And right now, a lot of them are still battling the pandemic, some worse than we are at this point, since we're trending downwards. So there are places that we know, as you said, we won't see a return to some of those cities in Europe, possibly in Asia, for a year, 2 years, whatever the case may be. We won't see the frequency we did. And American, speaking for American, won't be the size it was pre-pandemic for a good couple of years. Now, that said, our focus is keeping, obviously, our flight attendants safe. We're the flight attendant union, right? But we want our passengers to feel safe, too. We want travel demand to return, just like American does. We want people to get out there, and we most importantly want it to be safe, but we want them to feel safe.
We're talking with Paul Hartshorn. He's a spokesperson for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants, also a flight attendant for decades. We're looking at the state of air travel and what it feels like to fly now. Taking your questions about flying and how to prepare, 800-642-1234. Paul, I want to explore a little bit what American Airlines policies have been around testing, around contact tracing and quarantine of crews. What does that look like?
So American does have a quarantine leave in place for its all of its employees. Obviously, I would say this affects flight attendants more so simply because we are in, you know, the metal tube with passengers, many different passengers, sometimes up to 3 and 4 different plane loads of passengers a day. But they do have a contact tracing system set up. So if a flight attendant does notify American of a positive test, they have a way to contact all of the crew members that they flew with. They are removing them for the period of which they could expose others, and they are making sure that they're made whole in terms of pay. So they've really stepped up. They followed the CDC guidelines, for which we're thankful, and they are protecting us to the extent possible. It really does just lie on the flight attendants and passengers to make sure we're protecting each other. I know we're all sick of wearing these masks, and I know it's difficult. Listen, going to the airport is already a stressful job, right? When you're heading somewhere, add the mask protection, trying to keep it on your children, things of that nature, just adds a whole nother level of stress. So we need to do it now to follow the CDC guidelines just to get through this and get back to some sense of normalcy, of course, of which we look forward to.
Just some clarity, though, are there testing protocols before a crew arrives at the airport?
That we have our own private testing protocols. We fill out forms, electronic forms, before we go to work, talking about symptoms, talking about how we feel. If we have any symptoms, they provide testing if we need it, but you're not required to have a test each time you show up for work.
How do you feel about other airlines saying, you know, we'll monitor for symptoms even if a crew member tests positive?
I don't like it. I like what American has done in terms of allowing their flight attendants to not come to work sick. They have a process in place where you can be removed without punishment and also made whole or paid for whatever flying you have lost. I know there are other airlines out there that do say that, you know, just monitor your symptoms. To me, that's irresponsible for the flight attendants I'm working with, and that's also irresponsible for the customers.
As we start to wrap up here, you know, how soon do you feel like Americans will feel safe to travel, to get on flights again? Because one part of your job is to say, hey, we're doing all we can and you'll be okay when you get on this flight. And yet there are a whole bunch of precautions that you really have to take in order to do this.
Right. So I think as we see the vaccine more widely distributed, I think that will move Americans towards feeling more comfortable on the whole, right? So I think that as we see that, we're going to see a sharp increase in travel demand. Now, as I mentioned before, I believe that demand will be mostly domestic, maybe the Caribbean and Mexico leisure destination flying, as you mentioned before. But our goal is to not only keep our flight attendants and passengers safe, but our goal is to make sure that there is an air of safety in the air. Really, people feel that they can return. We know they want to travel. We hear from corporate customers. We hear from our customers every day that they are ready to get out there and travel. They just don't quite feel 100% safe yet. So that's our goal, moving towards that, keeping the mask compliance up, and just getting through this to get back to some sense of normalcy, whatever that may be in the new world.
Paul, what is vaccine rollout like for American employees?
So we have been working with American to try to get it available for our flight attendants. We finally do have some doses available in our Chicago flight attendant crew base. We are moving to get it into all 11 crew bases, obviously not just for flight attendants, but for all American employees at our local American Airlines medical facilities, of which are at each of our hubs. So that's moving. It's moving slower than we would like. And we see more flight attendants actually receiving the vaccine in their home states a little bit quicker than American is able to secure doses. But we're going to keep up the pressure on getting that available in the airports for our team members, for, you know, mechanics, pilots, ground staff, anyone who wants it, just to make it a little bit easier for them to access the vaccine.
And very quickly, should it be mandated, the vaccine?
That's the question. I don't know if it's going to be mandated. I do know that we probably will see some countries that will require our crews to have the vaccine. Mm. So that whole issue remains to be seen how the airlines are going to handle it. And it's definitely a sticky issue.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Kate, thank you so much for having me. I hope we talk soon.
Paul Hartzorn is a flight attendant and spokesperson for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants, which represents more than 27,000 American Airlines flight attendants. Ahead this hour, we explore PBS Wisconsin's new series called Why Race Matters and what it has in store for conversations around race. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a musician and podcast host from Wauwatosa.
Joe Wong was a musical kid growing up in Wauwatosa, where he learned to play a few instruments. But he fell in love with the drums around age 11. Something just clicked with drumming that hadn't quite been there with the other instruments he'd tried.
I can remember the first time I played drums with another musician and how incredible it felt. And in some ways, I feel like I've been chasing that feeling my whole life.
After playing in bands and doing some touring, Wong enrolled at Berklee College of Music in Massachusetts, which seemed like a great idea at the time for someone who wanted to make a career out of music.
But then when I went to the school, it made me question everything and subvert my own voice, and it was a bit overwhelming, so then I kind of retreated to a farmhouse in Wisconsin to try to parse through everything and metabolize the information that I had gotten.
Wong eventually hit the road again with guitarist Marnie Stern. While on tour in New York City, he had a chance meeting with his friend and former Fugazi drummer, Brendan Canty. They grabbed drinks and got into a pretty deep conversation about music and life. And that was the spark for Wong's podcast, The Trap Set, where he talks to other drummers about a variety of topics. Canty was the show's first guest.
That's how it all started. Basically, out of my desire to work through my demons with my musical heroes.
I have a lot of work to do. I have to finish two films, and I have to have a big soundtrack job, and I just had to be working all the time. And it's like when you start drinking at night, you know, you end up spending a lot of time thinking about going out and hanging out with your friends, and it's really great and it's really fun, but you really don't get half the work done you should be.
Right.
So I hate to lay it on you, but
I thought I was feeding the muse the whole time.
I know, right? So did I.
Now, around that same time, Wong was tapped to create original music for the Netflix series Master of None, starring comedian Aziz Ansari. A friend of Wong's, who was one of the show's music directors, reached out to him, so he gave it a shot.
At the time, I was working with a partner who still lives in Milwaukee, Didier LaPlay, and so we made some demos, and Aziz and the other music supervisor, Zach Cowie, were really into what we were doing, and that's how that happened.
And that's led to composing gigs for many other series and comedy specials. And recently, Wong has taken inspiration from all of the creative people around him and channeled it into his debut album, Night Creatures, which was written as Wong's father was dying.
My dad had a massive stroke in 2010, and ultimately he never recovered. And so I saw him lose pieces of his personality over time. And that's basically what the album is about. It's my way of working through that. All things dissolve in
time. As Wong was recording the album at an LA studio, he had a surprise visitor.
felt somebody behind me, and I turned around and Cat Stevens was standing there. And he said nice tunes, and that was enough praise to get me through the rest of the day.
Wong says he'd like to write more nice tunes in the future and find a balance between recording albums and his work as a television and film composer.
I've developed this muscle of writing a lot of material from my career as a film and TV composer, so I'm trying to deploy that muscle in service of making another album.
Joe Wong is a drummer and composer, and he hosts the podcast The Trap Set. He's a native of Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
And now PBS Wisconsin is launching its new 9-part digital series today called Why Race Matters. We have its host and creator, Angela Fitzgerald. Angela looked inward after the killing of George Floyd and wondered how she could elevate and center conversations in Wisconsin around racial inequity and racism. Do you seek out interviews or documentaries about race and lived experiences? And what ways does this shape your own experiences around race? Have you had deeper conversations about racism with friends and loved ones? How did they go? It's 800-642-1234. Angela Fitzgerald is host and producer of Wisconsin Life, and her new series is called Why Race Matters. Alongside her work as a PBS Wisconsin host, Angela is director of Family, Youth, and Community Engagement for the Madison Metropolitan School District. Angela, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Would you mind sharing how it felt for you and the thought processes you went through after the killing of George Floyd on May 25th?
Sure. I just remember things feeling different. This isn't the first instance of police brutality directed towards Black bodies, but somehow the kind of nationwide response felt different. It felt elevated in an exciting way. And for the first time, I was noticing that brands were coming out with their statements about Black Lives Mattering and how they felt, just making a lot of kind of public statements that hadn't really happened before. Mm-hmm. And it left me wondering, because at the time, PBS Wisconsin hadn't put anything out initially. So at the time, I was wondering, like, what is our stance as a network? And then also wondering what is my role as someone who works as a media personality for the network to really like highlight that this is an area of concern, not just in these other parts of the nation, but in our own backyard. And so that led to like a series of emails and just pitches. And here we are months later. So it really just for me felt like I needed to do something. And how might I be able to use my existing relationship with PBS Wisconsin to just put something out there that continues the conversation and moves us towards action within our state.
Yeah, I mean, you were proactive here. You felt this need to do something. How did PBS Wisconsin respond?
Oh, they absolutely were super supportive because I didn't really have any preconceived ideas that my thoughts would turn into something, right? It was just like, hey, guys, just wondering what we could do or kind of what the network could do that is a response to what we're seeing happen on a nationwide level. Because this was, unfortunately, before Kenosha, when things did come into our own state backyard, but did want Wisconsiners to not feel absolved of the issues, because sometimes it's easy to say like, oh, things happen over there, but they don't happen over here, even though George Floyd was in our Midwest neighbors, right? I still did not want our state to feel like, oh, well, that's an issue that happens in other places, because we know what the disparities are in Wisconsin. So they were absolutely supportive and willing to talk and kind of flesh out what it could be, because this was also occurring during the time of COVID. So production as we normally would have done it wasn't happening. And so I understood that. I understood the limitations around what we could do safely, but still felt like what might those possibilities be. And it has led us into waters that were uncharted for us. And I'm super excited to hear audience responses to what we've been able to put together, and even what could result following the launch of Why Race Matters.
Yeah, and so you interview artists and community organizers and health professionals. And so for all of these conversations, and, you know, you're having them outdoors, you're spread out. What were you trying to get at in these conversations?
I was really trying to get at authentic stories of Black people living in the state of Wisconsin who are also doing the work to reduce disparities in whatever their field or area happened to be. It very much to me was kind of a narrowing of the focus that I know we take with Wisconsin Life. Like, that's one of the things I absolutely love about my role with Wisconsin Life, is I get to travel around and meet interesting people who are doing cool things in the state. And I love having those community conversations. So I wanted to take a similar feel and similar focus and just direct it towards like racial inequities and kind of what does that mean for those who are having this dual role of being impacted, but also doing the work and celebrating the successes that are resulting from the work that they are seeing taking place.
I want to hear some snippets of this work. And in one of the episodes, you interview marriage and family therapist Myra McNair of Madison about Black mental health and trauma. Let's listen.
The numbers of how many Black people are dying from COVID, just that alone, we were seeing an increase at our clinic for mental health, right? And then after the murder of George Floyd, he said, I can't breathe. We've heard countless Black men say, I can't breathe. And I always explain with COVID and then with all of the racial unrest, we can't breathe as a community.
You know, Myra, as a therapist, I would imagine she carries all the burdens of her community and her clients and patients. How did she process what she was hearing in her counseling sessions?
Well, I absolutely love that within our conversation, she uplifted not only the significant role that she and her practice take to supporting the mental health needs of historically marginalized communities in the state and in Madison, but she also referenced that many of her staff are members of these communities and what are our needs, given that we are being impacted as well. And so she mentioned taking, like, I don't know, remember exactly the length of time, but they basically shut down for at least a day to make sure that staff were okay and to turn inward around addressing the needs of staff. And so I absolutely love that because it was completely relatable. I've talked to other friends and colleagues in the state who have had similar kinds of experiences in the workplace, but feel like when they join the Zoom calls, when they go in meetings, they have to put on the face because there isn't room for them to really reveal how they're feeling, how the additive effect of multiple pandemics is really just draining and depleting them, because there isn't that space created within their professional environment. So the fact that she was intentional about creating that within her practice, I so appreciate it. And I hope that others who run businesses are considering what space are you creating for your staff, especially those who are being impacted by everything that's going on.
How do you think race and inequities compounds that inability to show the true self, to, you know, maybe bear weakness, if you will?
Well, I think it's, well, and that may not be everybody's experience, right? Mm-hmm. But I think for some individuals, it very much is that this is something that internally that I deal with, but it's not a shared experience by others around me. Mm-hmm. And because it's not shared, it's not understood. I do not feel like I have a space that feels safe and where I can not only share, but also feel like maybe I'm able to receive support. And that maybe has played out in different ways for folks in terms of going to work right after maybe an incident has happened nationwide. And then you're personally affected by it, but at work, no one's talking about it. So it feels as though for others, it's business as usual. But for you, you know, you're deeply impacted.
PBS Wisconsin host Angela Fitzgerald with us. A new digital series she has, it's called Why Race Matters. New episodes drop Wednesday evenings at 7. First one premieres tonight. Do you plan on watching it? What topics do you want to cover and go deeper on? What are your thoughts on racial equity in our state? When was the last time you had a conversation, a deep one, with someone about race and representation? How did it go? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's go back to our conversation with PBS Wisconsin host and producer Angela Fitzgerald about listening more intently, about going deeper with Wisconsinites on these complex, stark racial disparities and how it feels to be Black or brown and call Wisconsin home. Angela's new interview series, it's called Why Race Matters. First episode in the series drops today. Are you a person of color in Wisconsin? What is your story, your experience like? Still time to share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Angela Fitzgerald is with us for 10 more minutes. Angela, I want to hear another snippet in your series, and you cover Black farming and land ownership. And this is a part of your conversation with the longtime fresh food activist and farmer Robert Pierce.
It was so hard to convince people that what I was doing was the right thing, because it was like they equated it with slavery. They, you know, the hard work, you know, was like, you know, they didn't realize there was a payout for that hard work.
Could you fill in more there? What did he mean about equating farming with slavery?
Sure. So he was just describing people who would observe him or his family working the land. And because of the limited ways in which Black history is shared, especially within our educational system, for many Black people, like, that is their sole exposure to Black people and working the land. It's when we were a part of chattel slavery. But for him, he recognized the value of not only land ownership, but of being able to provide healthy foods to your community and to your family, and kind of what that means. So it does complicate the issue of historically how there was a forced nature to working land, but then how that also lent to, over time, limited access to being able to own land and to be able to farm and to personally use the skills that were forced upon you previously during past generations. And so he does unpack kind of all of that while elevating his story and the experiences he's had in Madison as a Black farmer.
And a line that makes me smile from him is, you know, you can buy food for me, but I'd rather teach you how to grow it. What did you discover about his lived experience with food and growing food and the bigger picture of food inequality in Wisconsin?
I loved how he, and I believe he still carries this like marker as someone who owns the only Black-owned farmers market in Madison. And he specifically targets the South Side, which is a community that he used to be a part of, in terms of providing healthy foods to that community. And he mentions in the interview how that was the community where the first McDonald's was like basically erected in Madison, and how that kind of changed the nature of how people were able to access food inexpensively. So now I'm able to get cheap food, but is it quality food? Is it healthy food? Not so much. So he wanted to combat that and to still support like the health of his community by providing it in an inaccessible way within their own backyards. But it also speaks to, again, just the kind of removal that a lot of Black Americans have had from farming, from land ownership, from growing food that we took with us for such a long time. But because of historical barriers and other sorts of challenges, like, that is not as widespread as it has been. Mm-hmm. Though it's exciting to hear about kind of that resurgence taking place in different parts of the country.
Let's bring in Chris now in Racine. Chris, hi. What would you like to say?
Well, I do know that racism is a fact in Wisconsin, because I have a coworker last night who made the casual comment, this is as bad as being in a white store and having them follow me around to see whether I'm going to take anything. And we together work on a unit of children that are having mental difficulty, and some of them are from diverse backgrounds, where some are from white supremacists, and I have Black children that have been hurt, and the difficulty in dealing with this population, and some hate me for my color, and I'd say, okay, you must have been hurt by somebody who looks like me. I'm going to try and show you a different way.
Chris, thank you for those reflections. You know, when you looked at this series, Angela, did you look at education and how we handle young people in terms of these difficult conversations?
Absolutely. So one of the interviews we had that was so powerful was with Rudy Bankston, and he described his work to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, but also his personal journey where he essentially was involved in the school-to-prison pipeline and how that impacted not only his personal life, but the work that he recognizes still needs to happen within our state, because despite the racial makeup of our students in our school districts, they still are overrepresented when it comes to expulsions, when it comes to disciplinary practices. And then what does that mean, right? Like, why are students overrepresented in these negative ways within our school district? And we know how that plays out in terms of life paths, the school to prison pipeline being one of them, where getting in trouble in school heightens your chances of becoming involved in the criminal justice system. And then what does that mean once you're involved in that system? How are you then able to re-engage with your community? We know there are problems with re-entry, which is another conversation we had with Carmela Glenn around Black female incarceration. So it becomes this cycle, unfortunately, that begins at a very young age. And so it involves the multiple systems being linked in that way. And so how do we recognize where it begins and where best to disrupt the ways these systems negatively impact particularly communities of color?
Let's hear just a bit from restorative justice practitioner Rudy Bankston.
When you know you're a human, you're not going to accept slavery or oppression. And it's similar to today. When we know what we're truly worth, we're not going to accept. So just that education piece became critical, but not a white-centered education.
Rudy, looking at this through the restorative justice lens, how do you heal? How do you heal neighborhoods? How do you heal victims? What steps did he see are here in the future that we can take?
And that's such a complex question, right? Because I think we definitely attend to the individual in terms of their needs. But by just attending to the individual, we're not disrupting the systems that were the ones involved in the harm inflicted on the individual. So we need both, right? We need individual supports and restoration, but then also calling out the systems that created the conditions upon which harm then became possible. And what does it look like for those systems to look completely different than they have all along? Because we do recognize that these systems, many of them, if not all of them, arguably, were not created for the benefit of Black students, were not created for the benefit of Indigenous students, of Latinx students. And so because we recognize that, what should they look like in a way that does create different outcomes for these student groups?
As you take a look at the series now, what do you hope people take away from it? Because I'm sure you had to really pick and choose who you were able to interview.
Yes, it was so tough with COVID making it difficult. And we had a great advisory team, though, that helped us in identifying who to interview and the topics to highlight. But we absolutely do want folks to see this as part recognition of the issues, part call to action, as well as celebration of the successes that have taken place under the leadership of those belong to the communities that are impacted. So super excited to hear folks' feedback after viewing the episodes, which will be launching tonight.
Angela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Angela Fitzgerald is host and producer of Wisconsin Life and new series called Why Race Matters on PBS Wisconsin. We have a link to it at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we talk with a pair of real estate agents as we look into the status of the housing market, find out what buyers and sellers should know. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.